This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Andy Looney. He is a game designer, a computer programmer, and he operates Looney Labs. Andy, it's great having you on the show.
Well, it's great to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Andy. It's I love your games. It's nice for you to be on.
Thank you.
Andy, how did you first get into games? What were some of your original favorite games?
Well, I guess I would have to say I got into games as a very young kid, so my first favorites were things like Sorry and Rook and Mousetrap, although that tended to be more playing with the parts really than playing the actual game of Mousetrap. But Sorry would probably be my answer for my first favorite game, which I played with my mom. But then, of course, as I grew older, I watched my older brothers play games. I wanted to play what they were playing. So I learned to play chess with my older brother, and I watched them play Risk and Diplomacy. And as I got older, I talked my way into playing those games. Of course, I played Monopoly in that. But actually, one of my earliest experiences of game inventing was when I discovered the card game Nuclear War was one of my early favorites, and I remember trying to combine that. I did. I made a version of Risk that added in nuclear weapons from Nuclear War. And so that was one of my earliest game things.
I have a copy of Nuclear War, but I've never got to learn to play it. It's just there hanging on my shelf, actually.
Well, it's certainly a hilarious classic if you're in the right frame of mind to kill millions of people.
You're the creator of Flux. How did you come up with Flux? When did that come out, and what is unique about the game?
Well, yes, Flux is easily my biggest hit. We sold a couple million copies of it at this point in its various flavors. But how I came to invent that, you have to go back to another of my biggest game projects, which is these little gaming pyramids, the Ice House system, or Looney Pyramid system, we call it now, with the brand new release Pyramid Arcade. It culminates 25 years of developing games for these colorful gaming pyramids I long ago envisioned. But it's been hard to get them made. We got quotes in the early days. It was going to cost us molding in investment money that we didn't have. And one day my wife was complaining about how difficult it was to try to get these pieces made. And she said, "Why don't you invent a card game? I could get a card game printed so much more easily than these pyramids." And the next day, I invented Flux, and it sort of just popped out in overnight. I had some ideas that all came together real quickly. I wrote up a memo that described them, and dated July 24th, 1996, and it set forth many of the ideas that are the core elements of the game. And why I wanted it. I wanted a game that would be about change, that would change as you play it, but that in a game that you would that would be different every time, but that would be very easy to learn because the rules would kind of get a little more complicated as you go instead of needing to learn everything up front, and a game that would where you could change the rules. That sounded fun. People would the idea of let's change the rules. Everybody talks about it, but rarely do you actually get to do it. And so I did have some specific inspirations I can talk about further, but I feel like I've answered that question enough for the moment. Kick it over to you again.
Can you explain how the game works? There's four categories, new rules, keepers, goals, and actions, and there are different card subtypes.
Right. Yeah, those are the basics. You've got keepers that are things you want to have. Your basic milk and cookies, one of my favorite examples, which is in that very first memo I described. But time and money is another good one. Just time is money. But so sometimes there are concepts. If you have like zombie flux, you might have stuff you need to fight off zombies. But we'll get to that in a minute. But so the basics is you'll have keepers that are things you want and that typically go together with other things. And then the goal will come along and say, in order to win, you need to have milk and cookies. And so if you have milk and cookies in front of you, you win the game. Just like that, boom, it's over. But there's a whole bunch of goals. They're constantly changing. And now it might say, you need chocolate cookies. Or maybe you need chocolate and milk for chocolate milk. Or maybe you need time and money, and or maybe you need chocolate time because it's chocolate time. Well, that's actually not a goal, but it could be. But then you have actions that are one-use things that let you trade hands with somebody or steal keeper or something like that, which can be a great way to win. If you've got the milk and I've got the cookies and the goal is milk and cookies and I can play an action, steal a keeper, I can grab your cookies and win.
You said that the game is unique in the sense that you get to change the rules. Can you explain how do you get to change the rules of the game?
Well, you were setting me up for what I was just about to say. The fourth type of card is the one that really is where the fun is. Those are the ones that change the rules, and they're called new rule cards. So there's one card that's different from the other. It's got a different card back, and it starts on the table, and it's there the whole time, and it's the basic rules, and it says draw one and play one, and that's like gets you started. But then there are new rules that do things like change how many cards you're going to draw or play. So if you change it to draw three cards, then you just have to draw two more cards right away because you only drew one, and now the rules require that you draw three cards. You have to draw two more cards right away in order to come into compliance with the changed rules. Or better yet, if you change it from play one to play four, well, now all of a sudden you have to play four cards on your turn. You've only played one. You have to play three more cards right now. Or maybe it's play all. You have to play all the cards in your hand. Then there's a bunch of other rules that can kind of go that do other things. There's maybe some caps on the number of cards you have in your hand or on the table in front of you, keeper hand limit or hand limit. But some other just zany things. There's a real kind of love it or hate it rule that's in the basic version and not many others is called inflation, which adds a one to every number just everywhere. So suddenly, immediately, if it was draw two, suddenly it's draw three, and you get to draw one more. Or you have to. That then you have to remember anytime you see a number anywhere, it's one more. Or maybe there's one that requires that you let the first card you play on your turn be chosen at random from your hand by the player on your left. First play random. That's real annoying sometimes, but it just kind of shows the way the game can be very chaotic and zany in some of the rules. And that just gets you started. There's a whole lot of other rules that can happen as well as you get into the themed versions. Now, those are the four basic types. In the themed versions, there's a few others that crop up. Like in Zombie Flux, you don't want to have zombies. They're terrible. So we made a new kind of card called the Creeper, which is kind of like a keeper, except that you don't want it, and usually they prevent you from winning. Although, just to keep things random, sometimes you need a creeper to win. Sometimes you win by having the bad stuff at the right time. It's anything can win sometimes. There's also an ungoal that says nobody wins at all, and the game just ends. There's also another card that only occurs in a few versions called the Surprise that you can play out of turn to stop somebody from doing something. And a couple of other things that creep along like that in some of the weird versions. But one of the things that's neat about the game is that it's a little different every time. You know, not just in each from one game to the next, but all of the different versions, we try to have them have a little personality and something that makes them play differently and have some uniqueness to them. So that even though it's always, you know, the same basic game sort of Flux, it also is different, appropriate to its theme as much as possible.
And you've done both card games and board games?
Yep. And video games.
Video games. Out of all of them, do you have a strong preference for each a certain specific one?
Well, I did. When I say video games, I've done really only one. I worked for a couple of years in the video game world, working for a platform that came out and died before it really had a chance to catch on, the 3DO, if you remember that one.
Yeah.
Quickly killed by the PlayStation. But I designed a game for that using pyramids, actually, called Icebreaker, and it was really a lot of fun. And it's one of the most successful games that did come out for that platform. And if you actually have a 3DO, drop me a line. I'll send you a copy of the game free because I want you to make sure you have it. A reason to go hunt one down and buy one, actually, if you're interested. I'll even include the unpublished sequel, Icebreaker 2. But video games are so much harder to make and so much more of a production. When I left the video game world and stopped being a programmer, See, that's how I got into it. I got hired as a programmer. Went back when I still worked for NASA by a new startup company making games for this new platform, and that really gave me my chance to become a game designer in this kind of backdoor, sneaky way. I never looked back after that. I am not a programmer. Haven't done any programming in a long, long time. I wouldn't even know how anymore. Everything's changed so much from back when I was a programmer. Unless you need a vintage system programmed in C, then I might still be able to help you out. What?
You mentioned you worked for NASA. You were involved with Space Flight Center in 1986. Can you talk about that?
Love to. NASA looms very large in my history. It's near and dear to my heart. I was actually a second generation NASA engineer because my dad worked for NASA from when it was founded until just a couple years ago when he finally retired. But he was one of 150 scientists who helped start the Goddard Space Flight Center in 1958. And I went to work for them out of college myself, kind of followed in his footsteps. And that's where I met my wife, Kristen, and I both worked at NASA. And then after a few years of getting ready and practicing, we decided to quit our jobs and go full time for starting a game company. And we never looked back. But NASA was a lot of fun. I wrote code that flew in space for a few years as part of the Hubble Space Telescope repair mission. And NASA put every meal on the table for me from my whole life up until the time when Flux was doing well enough to start paying the bills instead.
You did a game called Ice House, and the way the game works is you have these glass pyramids, and there's also a
crystalline plastic.
Crystalline pyramids.
Yep.
And black pyramids. Can you explain how that game works, and where did you get the inspiration for it?
Well, that's, of course, a subject I could talk for hours about on its own. The pyramids are the thing that first got me started in game inventing, although really it was before I even dreamed of becoming a game inventor. My first idea was that I would become a writer. I did well in English classes and writing short stories, and I thought maybe I would become a writer someday, although I wanted to have a job, so I studied computer science. But I wrote a short story in which I described an imaginary game played with these beautiful crystal pyramids called Ice House. And the story never went very far, but everybody loved the idea of the game. And that led to a friend creating a set of pyramids like the one I described, and another friend coming up with a rules for a game that you could actually play with these pyramids that was like the one I described. And we called that Ice House, like the one I described, and we played that game for 8 years, and even published and printed a few handmade short-run sets of it. The very first thing we really did as a company, I talked about how we kind of were practicing before we quit our day jobs. We, Kristen and I and a couple others, put together a little partnership and made 100 copies of this game, Ice House, with these pyramids. Well, that game was too complicated and hard to really get. It wasn't a good enough game, really, and we didn't know enough about it. But it was still quite fascinating. But the pyramids themselves were so cool, were so great for inventing games, that we started inventing other games that you could play with them, and more and more. And in 1999, we finally had enough money to invest in that mold, and we got a real production run done of Ice House pieces. And by then we were packaging with 4 different games, and that was 1999. And we kept making more games and more games. And each time we'd make a new game, every now and then we'd relaunch the system around one of our new games and maybe feature a couple of games in the set. But we kept on trying to find the best game to say, well, this is the game for these pieces. But earlier this year, and it just came out a couple months ago now, we launched the ultimate compilation of this. It's called Pyramid Arcade, and it's an incredible box with 22 games and everything you need to play all of the games, which use these beautiful pyramids. They come in 10 colors. You get 90 of these crystalline plastic pyramids, and all the other parts, dice and game boards and everything you need, and a big comprehensive rule book that tells the whole story. The Pyramid Arcade set is the thing I'm proudest of. I call it my magnum opus. It's the greatest thing I've ever made. If you like Flux, you got to check this thing out. It's great. I could talk all day about the pyramids, but I'll tell you a little bit more. There are 20 games in the set that I designed. There are two others in there, one that have proven to be so great, designed by others. Actually, there's hundreds of other games when you consider all the ones designed by other different people over the years. But two of those games are so cool, I wanted to include them. And one of them is a game called Homeworlds, an epic interstellar space battle game that I like so much. It's so challenging to learn, and I'm so into it that I want people to learn it so much that if you can learn this game and beat me, I will give you a medal.
That's kind of like, I think, the game Stonehenge, where you got all those designers and they all made something with the pieces.
Oh, yeah. It's funny you should mention Stonehenge. I worked on that.
Yeah, I have that actually, and I think it's really cool where you have pieces and you work with them. Have you ever played Killer Bunnies? That's a really fun game I enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Funny you should mention that, too. We actually were the guy who's made Killer Bunnies asked us to publish it, and we were so busy working on Flux, we didn't have the resources to do it, and we're not really about publishing other ideas, other companies, other designers' ideas anyway. Our company is really all about publishing my own designs. Anyway, we turned it down, and look where it went.
It's expensive to get the boxes. You cannot get the red booster box, which goes for like $150. Luckily, I have all the boxes, and it's a game I always bring around, Killer Bunnies. Hopefully, you'll get a reissue soon.
Well, indeed. But also, Stonehenge was very much when that came along. I know all the guys who worked on that. I designed a game that came out only for the expansion, so you had to get the expansion and the base set. Like, so few people got the original set, and then even fewer got the expansion. So nobody knows my game, but it happens to be the most authentic and accurate game about Stonehenge from that whole set. Because mine was based on real events. Mine was called Stonehenge Hippie Festival, and it was about a bunch of hippies at a festival, which actually happened in the 70s and early 80s before it was all stopped by the Battle of the Beanfield. But then actually, Mike Selinker designed a game called Battle of the Beanfield, so I guess his is just as authentic historically as mine. So I take it all back. Anyway, never about Stonehenge, but it was cool, the concept of a game system. But I think its downfall was that it was sort of too specific while being generic at the same time. And also, they got a bunch of headliner game designers to design a bunch of games for it, but that doesn't mean any of them are really very good. It just means that they got against a bunch of game designers to knock some games together. Whereas Pyramid Arcade represents my 20-year struggle to come up with a set of really great games for these pyramids. And it's only the best games, and they're all really great.
You wrote a science fiction novel called The Empty City, and this book also has illustrations. Can you talk about the story behind that?
Sure. Well, again, I talked about how I dreamed of being a writer out of college, and that as I pursued a technical career, I worked on writing in my spare time, and that book is my first novel, and really it's my only completed and published novel.
Does it take place in a specific time in the future?
No, it's a kind of abstract, postmodern sort of future, sort of just shifted out of reality. And it's from the late 80s, early 90s. So at this point, it's a kind of retro future look too. But that's the thing. It also is set in a world where instead of like chess and backgammon, people play this game Ice House. That's where this book was. It included that original story and a bunch of others as it kind of pulled it all together into one big story that included through as a thread this imaginary game with the pyramids. So, I don't know where I was going with it, but that's what it was.
It's cool, though.
Can you talk about the design and aesthetics of the illustration? You said it was 80s. Was it created in the 80s or was it 80s inspired?
I wrote the stories the story and kind of pulled it together into a big novel during the years between about 85, 86 and 91, 92. I mean, I think it was kind of finished as a complete novel in maybe 91 or so. The illustrations in the published book were done about 10 years later, I'd say, when a woman who is now our customer service woman department at Looney Labs, her name is Allison Frayne. She first showed up in our lives, and she's the one who ended up doing all those beautiful illustrations, kind of based on some of my. She picked my brain and read the book a bunch of times. Well, she had read the book when we were publishing it chapter by chapter online, and she was eager to help us to publish a print edition.
The art in the game Aquarius, it reminds me of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, like the look of it. You know what I'm saying? Like that aesthetic-wise.
Sure. Yep. I don't know.
That's really cool, though. When I play Aquarius, it just reminds me. I get hungry, and I think of Ben and Jerry's ice cream for some reason.
Well, I'm very proud of the art on Aquarius. It's one of that and Flux are the only ones that I really did the art for myself. Everything else at this point that we publish, all the other things, we have real artists do the illustrations. But and even Aquarius, the new edition, my art was jazzed up and made it look even cooler by professional artists. But it's to me all the inspirations. I was, you know, I'm a child of the '60s, so a lot of that stuff, that look. The Ben and Jerry's hippie art look really harkens back to the 60s era psychedelic look popularized in particular by artist Peter Max and the movie Yellow Submarine and just a lot of colorful patterns that the hippies seemed to think were cool back then.
I remember seeing Peter Max at an art gallery. I got to see him in person in the gallery. Oh, cool. But I never shook his hand, though. I just saw him, and I was like a few feet away, but...
Oh, that's it. I've been a fan of his work since I was a kid, so I've never had a chance to even see him in person. I envy that.
Huh. You've been involved in marijuana legalization advocacy. Are you still active in the cause?
Well, I certainly still support it, and we're proud that a percentage of the sales from Stoner Flux are donated to our pick of some of the best groups. So we certainly provide a lot of financial support. But I guess I'm not as active as I was back in the day. We used to go to a lot more conventions and conferences, and I was a lot more sort of outspoken on the internet. I don't want to say we've won because people are still getting busted every day. And the new incoming administration's choices are worrying me greatly. But, you know, the fight has gone so far since it was in the late 90s when I first started speaking out on it. And, you know, with recent victories in Colorado and Nevada, Massachusetts, etc., it's really feeling like
California passed a...
California, absolutely. There. I was just traveling through... Washington State and Oregon, and it's amazing to be able to walk into a store and buy it there legally. So it's feeling like legalization is really taking root. But at the same time, the Fed keeps holding back everything they can to keep their entrenched positions. So the fight is not over.
How much have drugs influenced the way you think about games? Would you describe yourself as the Timothy Leary of a game designers?
Wow. I would never have thought to describe myself that way. I usually don't talk too much in favor of it. Really, I mostly just speak out against the prohibition. But if you're calling me to be honest, I will have to say that I do feel as though it has helped influence my creativity in a positive way. And, you know, it's funny. It's like, it's right there in the stone, in the stereotype of the stoner. It's like, whoa, man, what have you been smoking? Someone will ask when you come up with a crazy harebrained idea. It's like, well, if you're in the business of inventing things, if you want to to make a habit of creating, it can be viewed as a tool towards that creativity. Something that seems to help you have crazy ideas, how is that not going to appeal to an inventor? And when you then have some crazy ideas that actually are pretty great, and I can look at games that I've designed whilst under the influence and ask the question, would I have had these ideas if I weren't under the influence?
It makes me think. One game that I find fascinating is Cosmic Wimpout. And in one book, I think it was 100 Game Backgrounds, I think you wrote a part about go play Cosmic Wimpout. And I actually went to go buy it because of your advice to go play it. And I found it a really fascinating game, and it definitely has a cultural background to it. Can you talk about Cosmic Wimpout and how it like relates to such acts like the Grateful Dead and the history behind that?
Yeah, sure. Well, Cosmic Wimpout is another thing that obviously, as you know, since you read the essay, but for the benefit of those who haven't, it had a big influence on myself and Kristen independently. We both discovered it in high school and thought, wow, this is a fun kind of underground wacky game, and thought it was really cool. And then years later, when we got together and we were talking about, hey, maybe we should start a game company, we both thought back and talked and shared with each other how cool we thought it had been, what Cosmic Wimpout had been doing, and how maybe we could do something like that. So first, the game itself is wonderful. It has these, it's just 5 dice, so it's very portable and easy to kind of play anywhere. And it's a simple press your luck game. It's actually, there are other games out there very similar. You may have heard of Farkle. I think it's basically the same game as that. It might even be known as a points game you play with. Both of those play with regular dice. But what's fun about Cosmic Wimpout is that it has these interesting dice with weird symbols on them. So it's kind of like bizarre and otherworldly. And 4 of them are white and 1 of them is black, and it's got a weird symbol on it too. And it's just, there's this sense of being indoctrinated into a secret brotherhood of a secret society of people who know about this fun, interesting game that you learn about it from word of mouth, and it's got a bunch of kind of strange rules, but it's still basically easy. But, you know, if you know somebody else who knows it, oh, hey, yeah, let's play Cosmic Wimpout. And they also had a newsletter back in the days when, as I say, when we got into it, you could get on their mailing list, and they would send out this like Xerox mailing list newsletter with cartoons of, you know, anthropomorphic dice playing the dice game with each other, and stories about tournaments and rules and things like that. And so we thought that was really cool, how they were really building a community and being in touch with their players, and that was how they helped build their fan base. And you mentioned the Grateful Dead. I didn't actually know too much about that angle of it, but apparently some, you know, either Deadheads or the Dead themselves or somebody associated with the band or something, somebody was into it there, and it had this kind of hippie appeal, so I can see that. But they also, they did this marketing thing where they would have, they'd give out stickers that just had like this kind of, like, art from the game, some weird symbols on it, and maybe it said Cosmic Wimpout, and maybe it was just like the Wimpout symbols. And they would give out these stickers, and people would stick them on all around as on like the tour bus or on tour places, I guess. I don't really know. But somehow the lore helped spread through the Dead community, which is its own tight knit community, as you know.
There's like, I still go to board game night, and it's usually an odd day of the week, either Monday, Tuesday, or Thursday. And it's usually a group of friends that meet together, we play games. And it comes from different backgrounds, too. I mean, if you're in the city, most younger kids will play, like, Magic or Netrunner. When there's an older audience, they'll play, like, Euro games because they have an interest in economics. And so I think that's a very vast audience, depending what games you associate with.
I played games, as I say, I've been playing games my whole life. And to me, that's kind of how I associate and relate to people. So, you know, I like to play games in any social situation, and I'm always, that's one of my favorite times to squeeze a game into the slices of life where you can find time for, is over dinner. Like, if you're at a restaurant, you're waiting for your food to arrive. That's the perfect time to play a quick game. But I try to have. I believe everybody likes games, but it's hard to get people to stop and play them all the time in our busy society.
Can you talk about Chrononauts? That's a family of card games. It deals with time travel, and was that was inspired by Back to the Future?
Oh, well, that's yeah, I'd love to talk about it, but we'll get to the Back to the Future in a moment. Chrononauts is a time travel card game that is actually kind of like a board game, really, because you have this grid of cards called the timeline that you set up in the middle of the table, and it stays there for the whole game, and cards on it can be flipped upside down or back, depending on how you change history. Because it's all about, like, if you had a time machine, what would you want to do? You go to change historical events or go get live dinosaurs, the other thing.
And each of the cards is a very specific historical event with the date of that event.
Right. So, yeah, you could prevent the Titanic from sinking, but what will that change in the future?
So it's like the butterfly effect theory.
Absolutely. So, and there's some things that really make a lot of sense. You know, we know that if this thing had changed, then this other thing clearly wouldn't have been able to happen. And some of them are a little more like, well, that's an interesting alternate realities. Who knows what really would have happened? But it's a chance to play those all out. You get to go back in time and change these events, and then there are patch cards that give you alternate realities, some of which are great and others which are terrible. You know, I'm looking at you, World War III. But
so if you prevent, like, say, one of these events from happening, like, say, you have, like, the Cuban Missile Crisis, you have Columbine Massacre, like, there's more than different scenarios that could happen if you prevent that event from happening.
Well, sure. At some level, there's no way to imagine all the possible realities that could occur. I got to boil it down to a game somehow. So I set it up to say, well, if this happens, then this happens. And really, in most everywhere, it's kind of a one-for-one thing that we say, well, this is the reality, and then this is the alternate reality. 1945 is the exception there. There's so much craziness that went on. There's a bunch of different patches that could plug into that. But the idea is that we each play a time traveler, a chrononaut, if you will, from a different alternate reality. And we're trying to change historical events to recreate the reality that we each individually came from. So I might come from a world where Abraham Lincoln was not assassinated, and I need to prevent his assassination in order to get my reality set back up. And maybe you come from a world where Hitler was assassinated, so you got to kill him to get back to your reality. And maybe we disagree on those, and we're going to be flipping it back and forth. Meanwhile, you also might be collecting artifacts from the past or the future. And that is, you mentioned Back to the Future. Now, this Chrononauts came first, and then we made another version of it with an earlier slice of history called Early American Chrononauts. And then we did a licensed version of it based on the Back to the Future movie, trilogy. And that's actually sadly out of print now. But that was based on Chrononauts. But you will find some Back to the Future references and nods in the original Chrononauts game, in particular a sports almanac from the future. Huh. And a newspaper from tomorrow's news today. But there's a lot of references to that. One of the things when I actually think, because Chrononauts was inspired by the whole of time traveler literature to me, I was trying to have references to as many different time travel stories and ideas as I could have, which is why it was very important to have the ability to assassinate Lincoln, and then later the ability to prevent the assassination of Kennedy, because there's a whole lot of short stories that were written about trying to prevent Lincoln from being assassinated before 63, and then after 63, they're about preventing JFK from being assassinated. Plus, of course, you had to let you kill Hitler. Everybody wants to kill Hitler. There's so many stories about that.
It seems like today in game design, one of my favorite games of all time is Cosmic Encounter. And I love Cosmic Encounter so much is because it's always a different game every time. Sure. It seems like Flux is the same way, where you choose different rules and the game is always different every time you play it. And it seems like the best games, like from Magic the Gathering and other sources, people are looking for this randomization, or that there's always a different outcome, and it becomes experimental. as if the person is in this art piece and becomes a part of the game itself. Do you think games are becoming more random in the future?
I think, well, yeah, there's a lot to unpack on that. Certainly, I agree. Cosmic Encounter, the Cosmics, both of these games that we've talked about. Cosmic Encounter is also a great game, also influenced us very much. Also great because it's, like you say, it's different every time. It has a structure that kind of lets each card break the rules or change the rules, if you will, in its own way. And what's interesting and fun is the way you see different combinations coming together in ways that maybe don't even always work very well, but maybe they do. And certainly Magic does some of that, and Richard Garfield has certainly credited Cosmic Encounter with inspiring him. And I'm proud to be lumped into that category with Flux, which certainly has some of those same qualities. Do I think that's the direction that game design is going? I don't know. The big trends these days are, you know, the Euro games. You mentioned the economic Euro game kind of things. That's what people seem to want a lot in the hard gaming. But I tend to work in, as we said earlier, too, the more mainstream mass market appeal, the easier games, the fun games that are, you know, the lightweight things you start off before you get into that heavy game, or that you can get people who maybe don't usually play games to play, but they'll play that game, my game, because it's fun. And those games tend to want to be more of that improv style, different every time, zaniness.
Do you see video games as displacing board games and card games, or you still see board games and card games as thriving?
Well, video games represent a certain threat to the board game industry, if for nothing else than the time slice. You know, we're competing for precious time out of everybody's audience. I mean, out of everybody's day, there's just not enough time, and video games are cool and they appeal that way. And then as they push more and more into our realm where it's, you know, kind of literally board games implemented on a video game platform on a tablet, say, it's actually even sometimes appealing to be able to, hey, look, you know, there's all these chits and things to move around. And if you play it on the tablet, you know, Small World becomes an easy thing to deal with when it's all managed for you. I can see the appeal. And it does seem like it's a little bit of a threat there. But I have always maintained that there is no real substitute for the real world experience of sitting around with a group of your friends and playing a game with physical components. And one of the things I think I like so much about, as I keep going back to my pyramid set, I like so much is the tactile joy you get from manipulating these pyramids. And there are games that are you know, like Jenga-like or other dexterity games that you need to have physical pieces to play with. It's just not the same to do it on a computer, and it never will be. And the real experience of, I mean, yeah, it can be great to play a game with a friend in a chat room, but I want to be able to sit next to you and, you know, punch you in the arm when you make a joke that might expand or whatever it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you design the illustrations for the cover? Like, I'm looking at the one, the Pyramid Arcade right now. Did you design that one?
No, I have to give a big shout out to our partners at a place called Other Studio, and a woman in particular there named Eileen Tian. She and her team there did all of the design packaging work on Pyramid Arcade, the incredible box cover with its retro stylings and unique patch designs for every game in the set, and look and feel of the art and all of the game book and the game boards that are included. They did all that work, and I think they did a great job, and I think it's one of the things that's really helping it sell now, whereas previously we've always just kind of made it up ourselves, and it's never looked anywhere near as look good as it's looking now with her work. So thanks again, Eileen.
Are you a big fan of a kind of the retro futurist aesthetic? There's a lot of different ones. Like, there's this sort of 50s to 60s, like a space age aesthetic, but then there's also like 80s kind of retro futurism. Do you have a specific preference?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to kick it further back than that. I'm a big fan of actually the 30s, the machine age. The streamlined modern subset of Art Deco and
like the film Metropolis kind of.
Yes, absolutely. And some of the looking ahead to the future that was exhibited at the 1939 New York World's Fair. A lot of beautiful work there. And then, yeah, the 50s, early 60s, the Populux era, the Atomic Age. I have whole books on both of these, and I've consulted them. In fact, the Looney Labs logo was very much inspired by the Googie Populux era of the 50s and 60s. So I prefer those over the 80s, but that's because I'm old.
I like there's a lot of doo-wop art in I think Wildwood, New Jersey. That seems to be a beach area town, and it just reminds me of that whole like electric kind of hotel thing. It's an interesting spectacle if you see that vintage stuff going on. It definitely comes from a different era.
Yep.
There's a an artist I like called James Turrell, and his art is like you walk into his rooms and they're filled with like colors, and the audience becomes a part of the art piece. And so when playing one of your games, it reminds me as if that I have no will over your games, and rather the game is controlling me, and I become the player becomes a part of the interactive with the art piece. And so I'm thinking some of these games, do people really have will over some of these board games, or actually you become a part of the art piece and you're being manipulated? It's interesting if you think about that way.
Well, I think it's a collective experience. I think that one of the things that's great about games is the way the game designer creates a kind of a sandbox or sets up a scenario, and then the players run with that and they play in the sandbox, and maybe they come up with things that we never even thought of. Especially this is true for the RPG designers, who will create a module, a scenario or whatever, and then set the players through it. And players will think of things you never thought they would, and they'll want to do things that you wouldn't expect, and they'll go right off the rails.
Do you get a lot of emails from players with suggestions for board game ideas?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we get email every day, probably. Maybe not quite, but pretty often. You should make a flux about this or that or the other.
Yeah.
Do a Harry Potter flux. Oh, yeah, we haven't heard that idea before. Have you tried to get the rights? Do you know how easy that is? No.
How difficult was it to get the rights for Back to the Future?
Well, we did it a few years ago before it was a little bit resurged. We kind of thought we'd cash in on that resurgence that happened. And so we were able to call them up and say, hey. And we'd already worked with Monty Python, so we had one license example to say, yeah, see, look, we're a real company. We make published games of things. And they said, yeah, okay, sure. The thing is, they were so different to work with. Whereas Monty Python, they approached us and they were super easy to work with. The Universal team had a lot more things to say. Every step of the way was approvals galore, and it was just a lot more trouble.
There's also, thinking about that, how people interact with games, there's this one card game I like called Pretense. And basically it's a meta card game where everyone is at game night, but rather everyone has a role while playing games. If you catch someone doing that on game night, such as passing the rule book, answering their phone call, saying a joke, you call them out on that. At the end of a 4 or 5 hour game night, whoever has the most points wins. And so this game becomes a meta game. And I feel like Pretense the card game becomes a part of that art piece. It's something really strange where meta games are becoming popular.
Yeah, I actually have a copy of Pretense, but I've never played it. I love the idea, but I've never gotten around to actually trying it out. And I've thought of doing something like that myself. I love the idea of a game you play while you play other games in the kind of background, and you're trying to get people to say things. But, I haven't ever managed to design one myself. But you've played Pretense. You say, is it good?
Yeah, I mean, as long as you catch people playing their roles, it kind of becomes almost scary, because it's almost as if Pretense, there's a target audience, as if this is what people do while playing Euro games, or this is the typical someone who plays a board game audience. And so the whole board game geek crowd becomes a target audience, and Pretense the card game becomes this, you call people out on their roles, and then you're playing a game within a game, And it seems to me, is this metagame thing becoming a fad, or is people self-actualized the whole scene of playing board games, and now we're kind of lost, and we're basically interacting with these things?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's very meta.
It's interesting.
What do you see the direction of board games going in the future? Do you see with the rise of virtual reality, do you see a lot of them being implemented through virtual reality?
Well, like I was saying before, I think that there's a call to do that, and it's happening more and more, and I guess it's getting better and better, but I still will always be a fan of real reality.
You also have LooneyCon, which started, I think, this year, and where's it going to go from here? It's almost as if a convention based around games you've made.
Oh, yeah, no, it's exactly what it was. We had our first LooneyCon this past summer, and it was a big hit. If you want to see scenes of it, we put together a little 10-minute documentary about it that you can find on YouTube. But we're not. It was a lot of work, and we don't want to. We want to be careful to remember that we're a game company, not an event holding company, and that it becomes a. It is a lot of work, so we're not necessarily going to immediately do it again. We might do it every other year. We might do it next year. We'll see how we feel. It's still a little early. We might make it something that we do. In a kind of rotating way, like we're going to do it next year, but at a different city, and they'll have it in a different city every year, or every 2 years, or maybe every other year it'll be somewhere else. We haven't really decided yet, but indeed we had a lot of fun at the first one, and it certainly stroked my ego having a whole convention there just for people to play my own games.
I remember at Fantasy Flight they had Cosmic Encounter Con 2 years ago, but they never had it again. And I wish I could go, but I've never really been to Minnesota. And yet, I wish there can be more conventions or based around a single game. As if with LooneyCon, it sounds like you're making a religion kind of like with Cosmic Wimpout. Or am I taking this too far?
Oh, well, see, I'd push it in the other direction because I'd say that we have so many games in our library now that we can entertain you playing different games all weekend. Whereas, you know, I'm not sure I'd be ready for a whole weekend of playing nothing but Cosmic Encounter. Certainly not of playing nothing but Cosmic Wimpout. I mean, I like to play different games.
Yeah.
But we've got quite a library of games now of all the different games, not even including the pyramids. And when you add the pyramids, there is literally infinite fun.
Yep.
Do you have a personal favorite out of all the games we've talked about?
Homeworlds. Homeworlds. The one I said I'd give you a medal. It's so hard to learn. I want people to learn, and I'm trying to create this kind of gunslinger culture. I want people to learn this challenging game, get good at it, and then seek me out and challenge me. And like I say, I've got an actual medal. I've had it made up that's got a beautiful picture on the front of a pyramid that looks like a spaceship out in space. And on the back it says, I beat Andy Looney in a game of Homeworld. And I've only given up 13 of these so far. Gauntlet on the ground.
There's another game designer.
Player, have you played that one?
No, I haven't, because I have the rules for it. I'm looking at it, actually. I have a copy of some of the components. I want to get to it, but it's a very interesting game. I just want to play it with someone first.
Well, of course. It is featured in Pyramid Arcade, and I'm so into it. There's 8 pages about it in the book, whereas most games are 1 or 2 pages. It's got 8 pages. There's a lot of strategy and detail about it. It's a hard game to learn, but it's so rewarding because it's so rich and fascinating, and it's a pure strategy, no hidden information game like no other.
There's another game designer that I like, James Ernest, who does Cheap Ass Games, and he does the same style where it's this weird DIY. You get these little bags, and it's just a bunch of paper clips, and then he kind of makes sense of the small components. It's very similar to your own game designs. What do you think about James's games?
Well, James and I are old friends. We go back. In fact, we call each other our arch colleagues.
I know. That sounds very similar.
So, yeah. He and I both started our companies around the same time, and we're both doing quite well in our ways. He actually he had a great year this year with his TAC Kickstarter. He teamed up with Patrick Rothfuss to create a real-world version of TAC, which Rothfuss described in his books, kind of similar to the way Ice House was described as a fictional game and then became a real game for me. Except for me, I was a nobody writer kid, and Patrick Rothfuss has millions of fans. So, James is doing very well. I certainly admired his early work as well with Cheap Ass Games. And I will say that one of my very favorite games of all time is his game Falling.
Yeah.
A real-time game about being up in the air, trying to be the last one to hit the ground.
That game seems also meta, too, because it's as if the card dealer himself is a component of the game, and as he's giving out cards to the player, people are treating that as a game, and I always found that interesting. And I like it, too. Whenever I show people that game, they're always really confused, and they think it's a form of play or some game they've never played before. I really think Falling is as controversial as John Cage's 4 Minutes of Silence.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that Falling is certainly a fun and unusual game. So shout out to James. Yeah, James and I, we have a lot of fun when we get together. We each make each other laugh like crazy. He's a great guy. I like him a lot.
Have you ever thought of making a competitive version of Flux, kind of like Magic the Gathering or a Netrunner?
No. I feel like, to some degree, I'm kind of anti-CCG. You know, Flux came out just a few years after Magic revolutionized the whole world, and when I was first doing Flux, it was like every other game being published at that time was a CCG. And I felt like, why? There's so many games it does not make sense to be making a CCG. Why are you doing that here? So I was kind of very anti that. And I don't know. I've never really thought about it in that way. You know, deck builders have come along, but kind of made it a different style of the same sort of thing. But I'm just more into the kind of the simple, like, here's the game. Play. Here's all the cards. Just play with them. I don't know.
Yeah, they tried to make Killer Bunnies into competitive, and it didn't really work out well. And I actually just prefer Killer Bunnies as it is, and just it's funner when you play games.
Yep. Killer Bunnies is such a light sort of, you know, just a CCG. No, it doesn't make sense.
Yes, in the Kobold's Guide to Game Design, I really liked your piece, which you did about how to design games, especially the drawing you had where you have this thematic or concept. When I was trying to make my own games before then, I actually would look at that. And if there's anything I've learned from that, it seems to me that rules are just an interpretation, and rather it's just a bunch of things, and then people make up conceptions about those things, and then you play the game or something like that. Do you think your way of how you make games have changed since 2011, or would you critique or at least change how you make games and give a new updated edition of that?
No, I don't think so. I feel like the principles I laid forth in the flowchart are still what I follow. I don't have it right in front of me, but I don't feel like anything's really gone out of date in the way I've been doing things the last few years.
Okay.
Is it necessary to have a good understanding of mathematics to design a board game?
Oh, I don't think it's necessary, but I do feel like my computer background helped me a lot. I have some analogies about how humans are like computers, and yet they're not. When I was writing software for computers, it's great because you know the computer will do exactly what you tell it to. Now, you got to make sure your code is telling it to do the right thing, but the computer will execute every instruction. Now, on the other hand, games are like software for meat space for computers. You know, human computers execute the program of how to play a game in a way that's kind of like a computer running code. But the problem is the humans won't necessarily read the code correctly. They might skim over a passage. They might not read the whole sentence that's got an important clause in it. They might, you know, not even read the back. Who knows? So it's no matter how perfect the code might be written, if the humans don't look at it properly, they're going to get it wrong, and the program is going to crash. This is the challenge of writing code. I mean, writing rules in a way that gets the players to understand. Because it's one thing to design a game. It's another thing to ensure that the people who get it are playing the game that you designed and not some incorrect interpretation of that game based on not really reading the rules or not understanding them.
The best book I've ever read on game design, and it's kind of my Bible I used to love a few years ago, is Richard Garfield's Characteristics of Games. It's a big, heavy book, and it definitely has, in an abstract, anti-math way, it really tells you how to become a game designer without the necessary need of understanding a background. I always feel like if somebody wants to design a game, I always lend that book, Characteristic Games, to any friends. And I find that book a wealth of information. Have you read that one?
I have not read that one, and I guess I need to get it on my shelf because I'm not even familiar with it.
Oh, it's Richard Garfield. What's his name? He's a longtime friend with Garfield. I'm sorry, I'm blanking out.
But it doesn't matter. I can look up online, as can the other listeners. But certainly Richard Garfield is a name we all know, and a guy I know, but not too well.
Yeah, it's an interesting...
But yeah, I'll look that up.
Yes, I'm a huge fan of the book. It's actually about 4 years old now, and it still has... I would say have some longevity to it. It definitely is a huge book of goes by, like it says, characteristics of games, step by step. And basically, if you understand and read that book, I think you can apply it to anything and then just make a game from it.
Yeah, well, maybe so. I should check it out.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Andy, is there anything about your work that we haven't touched upon yet?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I've got other games we could certainly talk about that we haven't talked about at all. Lunacy, Mad Libs, Justice Earths. But it's not important, really. If you don't have any questions about them, I've certainly designed other games, and they're out there for people to explore when they want.
Do you have any upcoming projects?
Well, right now, we've got Math Flux at the printer at the moment, so that's the next release. And I'm in the midst of finalizing Chemistry Flux, so that's pretty cool. So those are the next couple of fluxes. And we're getting ready to republish Zendo, which was one of the most popular games for the Pyramids, but which we did not include in Pyramid Arcade, partly because the pieces in the arcade really aren't the right set. You really want a lot of just a few colors instead of all the colors and not that many of them the way we have in arcade. But also because we're planning to have a standalone new edition of Zendo that we're working on for next year. Well, this year. Geez, it's already 2017. But for later this year, which uses a slightly different set of pieces. Instead of just pyramids of different sizes, it's got pyramids and wedges and blocks. And so it takes Zendo to a whole nother level, and we're pretty excited about that. So those are a couple of things we got in the works.
Andy Looney, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
Thank you. It's been nice talking to you, Andy. I'm going to play some of your games this week, actually.
Great. Well, have fun. And thanks for playing my games.
Yay.